Good evening. We're at stage 7, or point 7, of the Lee Jong training, which is the guidelines for mind training, and the final 20-some slogans. Well, 20 slogans in 60 minutes.
I thought we're only doing 10 this week.
We're
11
doing 10.
Week.
We're only doing
10. 39 through 49.
Yeah, 39 through 49.
Oh.
That's
all
we're doing.
Great.
Michael's
going to... I'm glad someone told me that.
I thought that we had discussed that.
Maybe. Sorry.
I'm sure you were.
I've been really busy. Well, that's easy. Easier. 6 minutes. Actually, some of these could be... They're so interwoven... When particularly when we look at the 45, take on the three principal causes, pay heed to the three, never wane, and keep the three inseparable, are all basically dealing with the same topic, essentially. So that will be helpful. Okay, 39 to 49, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I have three points of reference here that I work with in case we've been working with Kamyon Trollic Rinpoche. We did start a long time ago with Start Where You Are with the slogan, but they were not presented in the kind of fashion that we're doing step by step. And so it's still useful to go back and forth to see how all of these are treated differently. And, of course, then we have Trungpa Rinpoche, Training the Mind, which is very abbreviated at this point. So it's much more condensed. But I think Trollic Rinpoche has done a fantastic job of... treating all these topics with great care and, really penetrating into how finding a way to present these in such a way that could really be applicable and how we can find our way in all this. Does anyone have any comments about that? Or I don't believe that we haven't really discussed this since everyone went on retreat. Not everybody, but some of us went on retreat. And even if we didn't go on retreat, we've had over a month to contemplate some of these things. I was wondering if anything came up in that context that you'd like to mention.
Well, that I feel like you could revisit and reread this book multiple times over and over again and still continue to unearth and have it pertain to whatever is going on in one's life with great richness.
Absolutely.
Michael, what is the essential use of point 7 that makes it different from point 6? Would you comment on that?
Well, point... Up until now, we've been given the essential overall instructions on how to deal with and apply our practices, apply our teachings to practice. These seem to be, as he mentions, act as a triggering mechanism to help us recall our attention to the present moment whenever we become distracted, and treating each slogan as a mindfulness practice. So they can help us work with just about all sorts of situations, and they're very, actually quite universal. Did you have another anything you'd like to mention?
I think that one of the distinguishing aspects of point 7 is that the whole emphasis is on changing things now. In other words, making sure that everything that's come up to this point doesn't dissipate like a New Year's resolution, but that the whole thing comes together forcefully to change our lives.
But it's about the dailiness.
Yeah.
The daily efforts.
Yeah, in other words, do this now. You can change it. If you're not changing it, change it. And again, if you missed it, change it. If you got confused, go back and change it.
I think that's a good point. I mean, no matter what, we can always come back to the present, which is the basis for everything, and as long as we understand, and one of the things that's being brought up in this particular point, a series of slogans, is this overarching sense of what the commitment really involves. Mm-hmm. What is the commitment to? I mean, we're looking at basically ways to live properly, decently, and really wonderfully, even if it doesn't have to be a big deal, but it's just simply fundamentally good, and a good way to generate and bring good into the world, and to find goodness in any situation we're in. So all of the teachings we've been going up till so far has really been giving us the basis for working with that, the kind of sense of, as Michael was saying, resolutions, the notions of making these commitments. And then now here's where the rubber hits the road in terms of our daily life and making it work.
So the key word is commitment.
Commitment, right. Commitment in body, speech, and mind. So we should talk about what that means.
If I could jump in there, to me it's more of an emphasis on bodhicitta. In other words, it's a guideline that's saying, okay, now connect it, everything that went ahead mm-hmm. to now what's your overarching spiritual value.
I think purpose. You're saying the same thing.
Yes, when he said interwoven, right, that's when
you're absolutely right.
So it's to me, if I could say, the reflection, the distinction I think that Trollig says is, somehow the previous ones are more disciplinary. You know, the more specific actions are commitments, if you want. In guidelines now is saying, okay, how are we going to connect all of them? You know, what's, to me, the overarching spiritual perspective? Mm-hmm.
Okay. So one of the things this presupposes on some level, I mean, to make this work is taking a vow. When we take refuge, we're basically acknowledging that we fundamentally accept our, in principle, that we have a Buddha nature, that it's our basic true nature, and that we're willing to commit ourselves to a path to discover, explore, and develop that. That's refuge. And that serves as the basis for fundamentally grounding ourselves in meditation practice. And as we go forward and learn how to tame our minds, bring it into some sense of where our minds aren't running us, but we actually are willing and realize the possibility of being able to take charge of the way we work with our minds, we then begin to discover also in the process of selflessness, deeper selflessness is recognizing selflessness in all, and to recognize somehow that other people are more important than we are. And so that's a major commitment. And when we take the Bodhisattva vow, that's essentially what we're willing to accept. It doesn't mean we have it all figured out and can do it, but we're willing to lean into that as a way of life. And these vows actually empower us on some level. They shift our wiring. They create a kind of a momentum in ourselves, or make a momentum available to us that previously we may not have known about. So that's why we do these things. That's why we take these vows. We're taking vows ultimately to our own nature, our own Buddha mind, and we're taking the vow to benefit others at the same time, realizing some sense of inseparability between ourselves, our own welfare, and everybody else's. So that's what this is going to refer to when we talk about dealing with these commitments. And I think, you know, if anyone wants to talk about that, wants to talk about furthering their path with Bodhisattva vows, we're very interested in helping you out and finding an opportunity to do that. So we'll arrange to have some preceptor, teacher, lama to help work that out for you. But I think it really is a springboard for really furthering. And so you can really understand, a lot of this sounds very inspiring, but this actual vow taking really sort of acts in itself as an inner impulse that can be a source of strength and continuity and perseverance.
It was interesting at the retreat, Nietzsche Mark Power, who was the one who did the Bodhisattva vows for us last year, was doing it for someone else this year and invited anyone who'd taken the vows to come and read. Mm-hmm. Take the vows with them. So, and it was very powerful, and it was also so different because I think last year I was so overwhelmed. I really, I like it was a wonderful ceremony. I couldn't tell you very much about it. And this year it was just this very powerful experience to be there with these other people and be with, listen and sort of appreciate the other person for whom it was her first time taking the vows. And it was someone who organized the whole retreat, so I'd always like, well, she's, and I realized it's that piece of like, when you take the vow, you're already down that path. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like you sign up and like, can I take the vow and then I'll start working on it. It's like, she'd organized this whole great big retreat for all these people. It's really...
Yeah, it was very special, actually, to witness that and be in support of other people's vow. And then, again... The thought that it's like a recommitment of one's own, it was like, kind of blew my mind in some ways. It was like, oh, I guess it's a good thing to do.
So do you feel the way, what Michael was saying, that taking the vow is sort of like an extra energy, it's like a boost for you to...
Yeah, you kind of. Yeah, it is. In fact, I when I took it last year, you know, I was absolutely like terrified, and I mean, I had all sorts of stuff going on there, and there was some kind of resistance, and you know, all this stuff. But I thought, okay, I'm really committed to this path. And this is the next step to do that. And it kind of opened up stuff. And then to recommit in a way this year, it actually felt like it allowed me to look back and see, to reflect upon where those moments where I could have done better to help other sentient beings in the past year. But then also... to remind me and to deepen the path in terms of making a commitment towards helping others.
Yeah, I mean, it's different than just saying, I like to be helpful. You know, there's like, I like to be helpful, and like, I just stood up in front of all these people with whom I have great respect and said, I'm going to do this. And then someone hands you the book and says, by the way, this is what you've just committed to. Like, here's the list of 25 things you have to do and 35 things you should never do and 50 things are terrible to do. I just thought...
And here's some books to memorize.
So actually, there's another thing, in case anybody is interested. I don't know if they've given you a Mahayana liturgy. If there's a morning Mahayana liturgy. And if you're interested, we can share that with you.
That's yeah, I think.
And it's a way you can actually just do a morning practice, if you like, to just essentially establish yourself with bodhicitta. It's a very simple practice. You do three prostrations and you make some recitations. And you basically just... And that kind of thing of recitations themselves, and that's why I really wanted to wait until we started the class to recite these. Because I thought, if we start reciting this before we practice, then we have an hour of meditation, and who knows what's going to happen and all that. And we're going to actually just do this now while these words are still fresh in our mind. Reciting these kinds of things really cause the mind to elevate and to rise up to a certain level of perception, which it's a support in itself. So we should trust this stuff. It's not just some kind of mumbling to yourself or something. It's actually a way to really rouse, you know, your own fundamental nature to... come up to that point.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I do the refuge vows and the precepts and four immeasurables and then the bodhisattva. And every day I will start praying.
So if anybody's interested, you can ask us and we'll arrange. You don't have to have already taken a bodhisattva vow to do that. it's also helpful to just help you understand what does that mean for my daily life. It just sort of sets the tone for the day. It takes 5 minutes or less. Not a big deal.
I felt that shift just going down this list. It's just a great reminder, reinforces that. So.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, doing the Heart Sutra, reciting the Heart Sutra at home, is something that you'll find helps you understand what it is. Even if you go, what is this? You know, you keep reciting it over and over again, and actually what starts to happen is it starts to make sense. You're not hypnotizing yourself. You're actually just opening yourself up to something that's beyond the normal stream of logic that we use, which is all based on solid things. And we're going into something more profound. And it's right in front of us. It's just here and now. So all of these things help to support what we're talking about in doing this path. So then it's not like, this is hard work. I have to huff and puff and, you know, do this spiritual calisthenics to actually engage on this path. It's more like it becomes more of a kind of a more unfoldment process, and there's much more sense of flow with our experience.
And it seems like these particular slogans are reminders of why we're doing this in the first place.
Yeah, so why don't we go right into that?
As Harry Bob said, the basis is bodhicitta, mm-hmm. is a refuge vow and the bodhisattva vow. And as Michael said, just waking up in the morning and reminding yourself before you kind of get caught up in the bullshit of what's the thing I'm supposed to do and the next thing and blah, 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 blah. It's really, these precepts are saying always, always keep these things in mind.
Well, that kind of discusses the number 39, all spiritual practices should be done with one intention, or all activities should be done with one intention. And we sort of recognize our working on ourselves is actually the door to opening bodhicitta, to understand it's not just I'm doing this all by myself and I'm the only one who experiences these screwed up thoughts. You know, it's more about just uncovering the basic kind of universal motivations that cause people to be so confused. And we have to learn this firsthand by just observing the way our own mind works. And in the process of recognizing bodhicitta, which is, does anyone have a quick definition of bodhicitta which they'd like to share with us? This may be it.
Awake heart?
Hmm?
Awaken heart.
Okay. Anyone else?
Compassion and action.
Okay.
Putting all sentient beings' welfare before your own.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all basically, everybody who's saying what they said is basically essentially the same thing, fundamentally. The open heart allows us to do that, just that very thing we're talking about. And so what that means, here he elaborates by saying if we deliberately bring kindness, sensitivity, and gentleness into our thoughts, speech, and actions, we'll start to experience a natural diminution of our self-obsessive tendencies. That's important. It's like the Shambhala teachings tend to say, conquering the world with gentleness. You know, you're not being, it's non-aggression. Non-aggression is far more powerful than aggression, ultimately.
It's really interesting, just this tiny little bit here where it says the Kadampa way of correcting adversity is to welcome pain as part of our practice and use it to transform our minds, which, just like Tong Len, it's sort of revolutionary. And it's actually page 200. It's hard to do. I mean, who wants to?
Well, I think that's
pain.
What we begin to realize is, first of all, adversity is the basis for waking up. We wake up by, first of all, needing discomfort. You know, it's not cool. It's
being
like
born, it's painful.
Yeah, we basically discover that actually we can avoid frustration no matter what we do. We can avoid not getting something that we want. These are inbuilt factors in our experience. And, of course, we can use them as a basis for complaint, which we always fall back on. That's just the most natural or automatic response. But also we can begin to recognize these things are actually helpers, helping us realize that we need to be dissatisfied with just going on automatic. And so at a certain point, pain and suffering actually become valuable to us. And we can welcome it. Because it's through that we actually gain these insights. Now, I don't mean we have to turn into masochists, because at a certain point, as we get more open to that, we begin to overcome all of the fears and antagonism we have towards avoiding, you know, and trying to avoid the pain and discomfort. And then we begin to realize there's nobody there to be uncomfortable about, and we begin to get a lot more, there's a lot more room to be able to participate in a situation that formerly might have just been utterly, you know, something that would drive us away. That we actually can lean into that. As Trungpa Rinpoche said, lean into the sharp points. Mm-hmm. You know, you actually are willing to be open. You're willing to be vulnerable and experience fundamentally pain. You're not going out and looking for what isn't appropriate. You're just actually being on the spot to deal with what comes up. You're not trying to manufacture situations that would like make put you out in front of the pack by saying, I'm really going to suffer hard.
Is the basis for this? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Is the basis for the benefit of pain in some way, you're saying, is it that we recognize that other people it's not just us, that everybody is.
No, it's not just simply some kind of a distant or passive sympathy about other people who happen to be having trouble. We have no trouble doing that. Just turn on the radio or look at the news, you know. But it's about actually realizing that this is actually how we open our hearts to pain. And fundamentally that this pain we understand in so many different ways, in so many different aspects and manifestations is universal.
Right, and it's not just I feel your pain.
No. So at that point, it changes. Your relationship to the pain changes. And it becomes a much more tolerable. Your level of tolerance, you could say, goes a higher threshold. You know, you can actually deal with that.
There's something really fundamental about acknowledging our own pain sort of cuts through our sense of impermeability, and we're so mighty, and you know, we're in this culture, we're so tempted to carry around this view of ourselves.
We make it such a big deal.
Yeah. And when we see somebody else suffering, we actually
understand.
Actually, exactly, viscerally, and sort of we're more equal. It's a great kindness.
So Erica jumped us into that next. that was the next slogan. All corrections are made in one way, or correct all wrong with one intention. two activities. This is 41. One at the beginning, one at the end. At the beginning and the end, two things to be done. So that, again, has to do with the notion of being able to frame our day around the idea of developing, opening up ourselves with a sense of bodhicitta to start with, and closing it so that there's some sense of completeness in terms of our day, and having that kind of sense of dedication, because we're really talking about increasing the sense of dedication to this path.
So this one's rather interesting because it's it transcends saying I'm a morning person or an evening person, for example. That is, you can't say, well, I do my practice in the morning, then when I come home, I just want to veg out. No. We set our intention in the morning, and then we rev ourselves up before we check out in the evening to say, well, how did that work out? And did I do it well or not? And what can I prime myself for so that tomorrow morning it's clearer in some way? So it's beyond being morning or evening. It's you check it out, then you check it, then you see how well. So you framed it. And I sometimes find that I want to do that with my sleep too. That is, I want to maintain bodhicitta all night, so I set an intention to do so. And then, just as I'm waking up, review that. So you can use it that way too.
And that kind of leads us to the whole process of these ups and downs, which is dealing with the next slogan, whichever the two occurs, be patient. Basically, no matter what we do, we're going to have up days and down days. We're going to have hills and valleys. There will be times when we feel like there's more of a flow and more of a sense of cooperation and a sense of some kind of ease of engagement, and other times where it's just a struggle and we're dealing with a lot of challenges and possible just sense of failure, or it's okay. It's like that's completely normal. I mean, that's part of the important thing. Is like there's nothing wrong with either being up or down. Ultimately, if we are willing to train in the sense of emptiness is the great leveler, it just basically evens everything out. And one of the things we talk about in Buddhism is developing a sense of equanimity, so that we don't have to get run away with being exhilarated about anything in particular, which, you know, obviously is going to have its opposite visiting soon after, which is a deflation. And we're not going to get completely destroyed because something happens we don't want, or a series of things, and things are crashing. That we can actually fundamentally go in evenness. And the point is that you actually apply our practice to those very moments. So, again, this ties in the notion of adversity or comfortable situations. They all come. You know, we never know what's going to happen in advance. But somehow just going with it as it is, and actually a willingness to be open, just a sense of unconditional openness, is going to help to sort of level this whole thing out. So no big deal either way, but it's fine, you know. And we can feel sad when it's time to be sad. We can feel cheerful and joyful. At other times, that's okay. It's not like I can only feel one way. I'm only supposed to be on this particular level. You know, I mean, these are the points of confusion we can develop in our minds of trying to be good people. And so obviously the one thing that we learned from, at least we did, those students of Trungpa Rinpoche, was everybody came with fairly cynical kind of position about being a bit, you know, I don't believe anything until I see it kind of thing. And, you know, tell me, don't just, I'm not going to just try to replicate my this kind of churchy quality of people being, self-righteous and, squeaky clean and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there was all that kind of sense of questioning, all those questions of where that is. What's morality? What's ethical? You know, those were really critical points of not feeling like, why do you want to buy into just what other people think, you know?
Non-credo. Non-credo. It's just like, find out for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's the important point. I think learning about and training and looking for the essence of experience, looking for the essence of our, this goes back to the absolute slogans, which will help to inform how we work with these relative slogans, is basically just investigating where things come from, particularly in terms of our thoughts and reactions. And if we can do that, we can begin to sort of lighten up. Because, you know, nobody's ever found anything that really looks on that level, which is, you know, rather amazing, considering how seriously we take ourselves, right? Our thoughts and notions and thoughts about what we are, how wonderful or terrible we are, and so on, in the world and everybody else. And so, you know, that's how we work with that and actually expand that patience or deepen that patience with some sense of just actual curiosity and inquisitiveness and investigation. So we continually apply that.
One of the things I think was hammered in by my teacher was beyond complaint. That is, there simply is no reason to complain, ever. And no excuses. Because people will always say, well, you're creating an organization that has problems in it, and that makes it hard for me to... You work with that. No excuses.
It's a little bit advanced, Michael. I mean,
it's the key point that he's making here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, ultimately, I mean, if we realize fundamentally everything's pure, then there's no reason to complain. I mean, if we even have a notion of that, if we get that kind of glimpse, then, you know, I mean, you know, this is kind of like what you begin to realize when teachers discuss Buddha mind or Buddha nature. You're talking about fundamental purity. Emptiness is purity. And so that purity simply means it's beyond being vitiated, or it's beyond being maculate. Maculate means, you know, it's not immaculate, right? Maculate means it acquires defects and stuff like that. So we're looking at a pure view, sacred outlook, actually, is what Michael's talking about when he says that. There's no complaint. This is what we're going towards. I mean, it's just completely natural. Let's go to the 43. Observe these two, even at the risk of your life. So these two. These two being... Anyone? Number 43.
Whether you're going up or going down?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. Observe these two. I mean, so they're referring to two factors that you want to remain inseparable from. And that's basically refuge and bodhicitta. Mm-hmm. So, again, refuge and bodhicitta is the basis for all of this.
So... maintain those vows even if it seems safer to do something more expedient.
Right.
Even at the risk of life.
Right. Most of us don't have to get in that position, but there are certain places you could end up in a certain society where if you didn't convert to their way of thinking, you know, you're going to be offed. but they tell you if you're in that situation, don't blab about it. Your commitments to refuge and bodhicitta, just live quietly and under the radar. don't invite victimization. Learn the three difficult points, or as Trungpa Rinpoche says, train in the three difficulties.
I like that one.
Okay. You want to say anything about it?
So Emma Chodron, I remember, she has some really good words. She just says, it's like seeing when you get caught in the kleshas and you see yourself like, oh, this person did this thing that irritates me and I'm about to do that same thing that I do every time. It's like, it's the first step is just seeing that that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then she said the second thing is just trying to choose. Mm-hmm. Like she just said, you can do anything else to do. Just if you could do anything else. And I've done like just sort of like hum songs to myself when I was about to scream at someone. But she said, you just can do anything. Like, just breaking that sort of like mm-hmm. habit of, this person talks to me about this thing, and it irritates me, and it pisses me off, and I'm going to turn around and talk to them about that thing that I don't like about them, because so there. And you're like, oh, well, that's been getting us really far for the last 25 years. Let's see. So really, just to like, try anything else. You know, that's the piece that hits me, is that knowing that you do, like, it's not just random things, but you have these just patterns that you
be so predictable.
Yeah, but it's even more that you're like, you're predictable to the other person, but you're predictable to yourself. Like, you could see, oh, wait.
But isn't it also arising, abiding, and
ceasing.
Ceasing, yeah. And it feels like that. This is equated to that as well. Like we're witnessing something. We're watching it arise in us. We're sitting with it, and then we're watching it go.
Our text suggests using the four immeasurables or limitless ones. So having practiced that, we make use of that.
To do something. But the other point, Herman points out, is like the third step is really like seeing if you could not be triggered so much by that thing. Like not, like, so it's the person says the thing that irritates you and you're like, oh, my instinct is to lash out and I'm going to say this thing to irritate them. And so the step one is notice that that's what you want to do. Step two is don't do that. But then step three is see if you can get to a point where you like realize like you don't need to, you don't have to get worked up.
Well, I think that's the other point about the seeing thing. Seeing is extraordinarily powerful. Our capacity to recognize, to simply see the situation is space. And as we get more trained in that, this is the critical point. The recognizing is the first point, because we need to simply have that capacity to see without making any judgment about it, but just seeing it. And then as we get more familiar and discover the spaciousness that's in that actual space, we discover that freedom to suddenly go, well, wait, I don't have to do that. I mean, I have these, it's not like it has to go down this predictable path. You know, there's room to turn right or left or switch channels. I mean, there is this possibility. But I have to start with seeing. I have to be willing to just actually open myself up to the natural state of observing neutrally. There's a neutral quality. The observation, you know, our awareness doesn't care whether something's good or bad. Awareness is just aware. That's the important point. And as we train in awareness, we begin to realize more and more about what that is. And it's very powerful, even though it's just like seeing it, like, okay, you know. But actually, suddenly there's this space.
So this evening, there were two women who were standing out there talking and talking and talking. Oh, my God, my teacher wanted, like, wow, you can't be that noisy. That's so irritating. And then when one finally said, so see you later. And there was, I so much wanted to say, see you later, like shout out from here, like we've all been listening. And then I just laughed at myself because I'm like, oh, you just want to just be like that's so funny. That's what you want to tell people. Like you're not supposed to stand out there and be noisy.
That's a reaction I share with you too. I've been very times the irritation, aggravation boils up, and then you see it, and you chuckle. You're like, this is not, it's nonsense.
Like,
and I'll never forget is after, you know, our meeting, the first time I actually experienced that, it was just so clear, and then it repeats.
So are we, he seems to be naming them all too. I mean, he's saying that recognizing the conflicting emotions is naming them, like he talks about jealousy.
You could start by labeling them, just like we label thoughts. You know, when we started to meditate. But at a certain point, you don't have to label every time thinking. You see what it is. You know, I don't have to go, well, which kanda is now acting up or klesha manifesting. It's more like, you know. And that already loosens things up considerably. If we're willing to lean into that kind of simple act of seeing.
You see that it's not necessarily aggression all the time. It could be desire, it could be greed, it could be jealousy. There's a whole gamut of different colors going on there as we start to experience it.
And they can often be so artfully blended. We have our own kind of way of developing our klesha attacks. They're not only simply classical jealousy, you know, that's all there is and nothing else. We could actually have it kind of doctored up with some... maybe a little bit of seduction involved in that, and figuring how to grease everybody's wheels so we sort of like don't make ourselves uncomfortable presence and we can still indulge in our little thingy, you know. I mean, there's all kinds of different ways of being able to get away with being able to be a neurotic jerk, you know.
And, Righteousness.
Yeah, and just basically socially acceptable.
I started with that.
Okay, I don't want to dwell too long. We have these now 45, acquire the three root causes. This is actually very important, I think. And as I mentioned earlier, 45 and 40.
46 are others.
Yeah, 46.
Those are the only ones on your schedule, actually.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And the three inseparable, 47, because...
Oh, sorry, up to 48.
Oh, yeah. So I think we'd like to look at that. You know, the one thing about this whole issue that we have with teachings is a teacher. And... right? Yeah, you know, they kind of come together. I mean, let's face it, in reality, the teachings have to be important. If there's just a teacher, it could be somebody who has very charismatic quality and seems to have this capacity of extraordinary achievement. But, I mean, the teachings have to be what's meaningful, because the teachings are what actually we can take and use for ourselves and also share with others. So that's the critical thing. But the teacher is there. And so in our case, I think we have to look at, we do not have a personal teacher in this room, you know, that we all share. However, we have the tradition, the lineage of teachers. And that we have. And we all can share that with you. And I think at this point, the best thing to do when you read these kind of instructions about Kalyana Mitra, spiritual friend, is to understand that that tradition is very alive and very present. And so that sense, that's a sense of where we can draw on a lot of inspiration. I mean, if you meet a teacher and you have your own personal relationship, that's great. I mean, we're talking now about a full Kalyana Mitra, or as Trungpa Rinpoche and Sravak Rinpoche say, it can also be the guru. But, you know, we are a Mahayana teaching here. We're not dealing with Vajrayana, so it doesn't have the same ultimate gravity that a guru does in the Vajrayana. However, it's really important, because without this kind of recognition of people who have really achieved, manifested bodhisattva and Buddha qualities, it's hard to really just view these as abstract principles. It's nice, it's good to see them embodied in people. So reading about teachers who have really made really important contributions through this whole process, very helpful, and to understand and make a connection with that sense of tradition, so that whether you formally engaged or not, you have a sense of connectivity with them, and it becomes a source of strength. I mean, you may have met people who may have affected you one way or the other that way, and there are certainly some teachers in them right now who are excellent, and when you see somebody like that who really does manifest or simply is able to communicate on that level, it's very precious. So that's one side of it. And then we have spiritual instructions, which is basically, as he says, essentially, the quote, taming the mind, and of course, training the mind. Because taming the mind is the first step of training the mind. And the mind can get talked into cooperating when it begins to realize all it's doing is hurting itself by pursuing its own neurotic tendencies. Right? And the other thing that's talked about here is a supportive environment, which he talks about in terms of livelihood, and having some sense of support to do your practice, time and space. And then Pema Chodron brings up the fact, the notion of a precious human birth. So we're going through the sense of the four reminders there. That is ultimately the first precious human birth, free and well favored, is very critical in terms of being able to understand how fortunate it is to encounter Dharma and have the capacity to practice it. So really highly unusual and really auspicious kind of circumstances. So just to have that opportunity is great.
And rare.
Yes, it is. Very definitely. Okay, don't allow three things to diminish is pretty much talking about something the same. Interested humility toward the Kalyana Mitra, or a sense of real, just genuine, open-hearted appreciation and recognition an admiration for someone or a person or a human being who can actually live these kind of higher potentials and realize and manifest them. Joy in our practice, which is fundamentally great. And commitment to the path or conduct. Upholding and maintaining the vows we've made, and also dedicated. The other factor which is really important is in terms of this twofold idea of the notion of day and night, the notion of opening the day with bodhicitta and closing it with some sense of review or, that kind of thing, is also simply whether we know whether it's effective or not, dedicate our efforts, whatever efforts we have made to work on ourselves and to actually make life better for being in this world, we should dedicate that merit all the time. Dedication is really important. So then, make the three inseparable. Well, that's basically creating virtue through our body, speech, and mind. But it refers also to the notion of the unity of the teacher, the teaching, and the practice. That there is some sense of a complete integrity with our life.
In Rinpoche, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche's book, he has a very tiny little brief sentence, and he said, in body, speech, and mind, you should be inseparable from Lojong. Mm. So
though speech doesn't go off on its own into space unconnected to the others, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. I think having a sangha helps. Having spiritual friends, friends who are on the path, people who you can share, your experiences with, knowing that you're not just an isolated fragment out there in the middle of nowhere, dangling away in space, but actually that there is a way of mutual support we find with practicing with each other, and that's also very important. In fact, that's really important. Oftentimes, if you want to find a teacher, it's good to find people who share your values, and that helps to sort of develop a kind of a magnetic energy to bring a teacher situation, because you have people who are commonly focused on that same thing. It's not just one person alone. I mean, it can happen both ways, but that's part of, I think, the other support when we talk about that. Environmental support or support of environment is actually recognizing how having friends on the path is so helpful. Sangha. Mm-hmm.
That's the power of you participating in the vows, having sort of been there and done it already, that you're the strength of you being there while other people were taking vows. It's very important.
Is this the last one we're talking about? Is this the last one, 48?
Yeah. 48, yeah.
Train in all areas without partiality, or, as it says, wholeheartedly, Rinpoche said, Trungpa Rinpoche, pervasively or wholeheartedly.
Both.
Yeah. Just giving yourself totally. I mean, this is actually, how do we want to live is just give yourself totally to really being here and giving your all to being here. I mean, that's it, right? There's nothing better to do. I mean, honestly. And, we could just say, this is not working out the way it's supposed to. Oh, my God, everything's going wrong. Fine. Let me just be here with it. Let me learn. Let me open up to give myself to it. Pain, pleasure, they're just all fleeting. It doesn't matter. They're kind of byproducts to the reality of the situation, which is just continuously open-ended. And as we, if you, actually are willing to trust a sense of wisdom in your life, then that becomes the basis itself. That, you know, how many people attended Conroe Retreat teachings in the summer? Anybody here? A couple of people.
I could only go the last day.
Yeah. I mean, that was just like continuously gold coming out of a faucet, you know. And it was all about just that. Training and understanding how wisdom is fundamentally ever-present in everything. But I think basically just really that's this nature of generosity. It's a form of it's your offering. You know, when we talk about being in the world, can we be here to simply make some kind of a contribution? And that means just really making our life the offering to the world. It's unconditional on some level because it's going to take so many different forms and ways of manifesting itself or opportunities where that could occur. But I mean, I think the point of just this openness, and that is the key with the Heart Sutra, about why the Heart Sutra is so essential to all this, because it's simply talking about the implications of this Heart Sutra is complete openness, unconditional openness. And that's what emptiness is. Emptiness is openness. It's unbounded openness. It's a willingness to not hold.
Without credentials. Dharma without credentials.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay, well, that's as far as I can get tonight.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope this was helpful. And I think at the same time, if there's anything that you look at or listen to later, if you choose to, and you feel like, well, maybe we should bring, I don't feel afraid to bring up what we've been studying up until now also into context of where we're going, because I think it's really important to sort of, we're trying to integrate this with our lives and make it actually something that works for us. We want to see how this works. You know? We want to test it. So, I mean, that's the whole point. Okay.